good to see everybody out tonight, and it's good to be here. Psychiatry students one day were in their college class when their professor began a discussion to prove a point. He said, "What we're going to talk about today are the emotional extremes that many mentally disturbed people go through. For example, what is the opposite of joy?" he asked one student. "Sadness," the student answered. And to another student, "What is the opposite of depression?" "Elation," she replied. Finally, turning to a young man wearing a Texas Longhorn hat, he said, "What is the opposite of woe?" And he said, "Well, teacher, I suppose the opposite of woe would be giddy up." "Oh, come on, that was a better joke than that." Well, depression, that's what we're going to talk about tonight. According to the psychiatrist Frank Minerith and Paul Meyer, a majority of Americans suffer from a serious clinical depression at some point in their lives. Most of these people never get help. They just fight this battle on their own. If you look at the ad for one of the leading antidepressant medications, it has these words. It says, "Depressed mood, loss of interest, sleep problems, difficulty concentrating, agitation, restlessness." And then it concludes with these words, "Life is too precious to let another day go by, not quite feeling yourself. If you've experienced some of these symptoms nearly every day for the last 2 weeks, a chemical imbalance is to blame, and you can feel life slip away and be difficult all day." Well, kind of to read that advertisement, that would lead you to believe that most, if not all, of those suffering from depression are victims of a chemical imbalance. And indeed, the holy grail for psychiatrists is to find that magic pill, that powerful potion that will correct the imbalance and give people everywhere relief from the dark moments of sadness and hopelessness. Depression is a very real part of life for many people. What I find interesting, if you want to turn over to 1 Kings 19, that's where we're going to be at. At the famous Minerith Meyer Clinics, they give the average week totals. They say that up to 50,000 people visit them for therapy. And 75% of those people, Dr. Meyer says, will either have clinical depression or some sort of other anxiety disorder. And again, I want to stress that depression can be a very real problem. But what I find interesting is God gives us a case study for clinical depression right here in 1 Kings 19. From this text, we find that Elijah had experienced really some of the classic symptoms. He experienced fear. There in verse 3 of chapter 19, it says that Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. Elijah suffered suicidal tendencies. There in verse 4, it tells us there that Elijah prayed that he might die. "That I've had enough, Lord," he said. "Take my life. I am no better than my ancestors." Elijah suffered from excessive tiredness. Verse 5 says that he lay down under a tree and fell asleep. 1 Kings 5 stresses that he slept for a couple of days and maybe longer. Elijah had the feelings of rejection. Verse 10 there says that "I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left, and now they are trying to kill me too." And he experienced this depression for a long time, maybe as far as up to 2 months. What's really bizarre about this, and just the days before this, Elijah had preached one of the greatest sermons of his life. He had confronted 400 prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, and he had exposed them as false prophets that they really were. And because of Elijah's faith and obedience, God literally sent down fire from heaven to consume the sacrifice that he had placed upon the altar. And then a few hours later, he sent a downpour of rain on a land that hadn't received rain for up to 3 years. Now, why would a man who had just preached an impressive message and had experienced some of the most powerful displays of God's power, why would he suddenly be crippled by fear, hopelessness, and despair? Why would he run away to a desolate corner of the world and seek to die? There's probably all kinds of reasons, but the fact is that Elijah did. And what this tells us is that even God's most dynamic servants can suffer from depression. It's not necessarily a mark of a lack of faith. It's not necessarily a mark of an immoral lifestyle. Elijah, in his time, was the man of God in his day. Now here we find him so far down in the depths of despair that even up looks wrong to him. But that isn't where God left him. God didn't say, well, sorry, Elijah, you have a chemical imbalance. Paxil, those things haven't been invented yet, so there's nothing I can do to help you. No, long before psychiatry was ever thought of, long before healing could be brought in a little tiny pill, long before we had clinics and psychiatrists and psychologists, and I don't mean any respect or disrespect to any of those folks or the clinics that they run, but long before all of that, God healed a man of depression, and it was not an isolated instance. What God did for Elijah, he could do for you and me. And I want you to notice what God did to heal Elijah. God recognized that Elijah's depression was not an imaginary problem. Elijah's depression was very real. It was a tangible thing. You could almost cut it with a knife, and God didn't say, Elijah, get a hold of yourself. Now, this is a sinful attitude to have. Where is your faith? That's not what happened. God didn't treat Elijah roughly. In answer to Elijah's prayer to die, God just lets him sleep. And then God's angel feeds him and then lets him sleep some more. And then God sends him down to the desert in the south for 40 days and nights. And in all that time, God doesn't say a word. God doesn't offer any counsel. God doesn't set Elijah down and have a face-to-face talk. In all that time, Elijah is left alone. Elijah is given time to rest and to think. There's a writer that tells a story about 25 years ago. He says that one of his nephews died in a fire. And he said that his mother, the boy's grandmother, was home alone when she received the call that the boy had died. And again, she was alone as she heard that news, and something inside of her snapped or broke. And when her husband got home, he found her disoriented and in a state of shock. And as the days went on, the son had the conversation like this. She would say, is David really dead? And he would say, yes, he's really dead. And then she would talk a while about him, and eventually her eyes would glaze over, and she would look and say, is David really dead? And they would say, yes, he really is. This would go on for quite some time. They took her to the doctor, and the doctor advised that they should put her in the hospital. But her husband said, we're not going to do that. I believe if we do that, we won't ever get her back. And the writer said for the next few days that nobody left her side, especially her husband, that he waited on her, he held her, he spoke to her kindly. No probing questions, no pink pills, no nurses in white, just rest and love. And in time, he said, she recovered and she dealt with her grief. Well, sort of in essence, I'm not saying that's the thing to do, but in essence here in 1 Kings, that's what God did with Elijah's depression. And I want you, again, to notice what he did. The first thing he does is sort of he sends Elijah to church. And second, God had Elijah tell him what the problem was. And then third, God dealt with the false beliefs, the false ideas that were fueling Elijah's depression. And then finally, God gave Elijah something to do. So we'll take each of those one step at a time. That first thing, God sent him to church. God sent Elijah to Mount Horeb, where God had given Moses the law. Church really is one of the best places to deal with depression. When church is done right, it's the place where we can come and listen to each other and to help each other. Paul writes in Galatians chapter 6, verse 2, that we should bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. Back in 1999, Duke University conducted a study of nearly 4,000 older adults, and this was one of their conclusions, that attendance at a house of worship is related to lower rates of depression and anxiety. But church really doesn't stop with being at a house of worship. Time alone with God in prayer and Bible study is a powerful antidepressant. A man by the name of Andrew Newberg, the director of clinical nuclear medicine at the University of Pittsburgh, he used the SPECT technique, S-P-E-C-T technique, and he made a very interesting discovery. Newberg studied the brains of religious individuals who either prayed or meditated. And his team found dramatic increase in action in the front region of the brain called the prefrontal cortex. This region is associated with judgment and empathy. The group also discovered that decreased activity in the region of the brain known as the superior parietal lobe, which gives us our sense of self. The findings there seem to indicate that people, while engaged in spiritual pursuits, felt the loss of self. Newberg said that prayer and meditation have been shown to lower the risk of depression and heart disease and improve the immune function. So again, first, God sent Elijah to church. Second, God had Elijah tell him what the problem was. In 1 Kings 19, verse 13, God asked Elijah, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And God didn't just ask that question once. He asked Elijah that same question two separate times. "What are you doing here?" Well, didn't God know? Of course, God knew. He had sent Elijah to this mountain. But Elijah needed to vocalize what was wrong in his life. Elijah needed to explain what his idea of the problem was. And once Elijah verbalized his belief of what was wrong, then we get to that third point, that God dealt with those false beliefs and those false ideas that were fueling Elijah's depression. Jesus at one point in his ministry said, "The truth shall set you free." Well, why is that? That's because false ideas and false beliefs, especially false ideas about God, have a power to put us into bondage. Our lives are built around what we think is true about life. And if the foundation of that reasoning is based on wrong information or impressions, the result can be devastating. Elijah's reply to God revealed what Elijah thought, what Elijah had wrong. Elijah didn't think really that God was doing anything. 1 Kings 19:14 gives us that reply. Elijah replied to God and said, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left, and now they are trying to kill me too." Hidden in the midst of that statement is this accusation. "I've been beating my head against the wall and serving you, Lord. Everything seems to be falling apart around me. So what have you been doing, God?" That's really what Elijah's saying here. And so God corrects Elijah's thinking. He tells him, "Elijah, you're not the only one left." 1 Kings 19:18 has God's reply. God tells Elijah, "I have reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knee have not bowed down to Baal and whose mouths have not kissed him." God's saying, "Elijah, I have not been doing nothing." That seems to be what God's saying. In fact, he says, "I'm just getting started." Verse 15 through 17 says, "Go back the way you came to the desert of Damascus. And when you get there, anoint Hazael, king of Aram, and anoint Jehu, king over Israel, and anoint Elisha to succeed you as prophet. Jehu will be will put to death any who escape the sword of Hazael, and Elisha will put to death any who escape the sword of Jehu." In other words, God's saying, "Don't worry about Elijah. I've got this under control. I am doing something." When our Allied troops made their way across Europe to cross Hitler's forces, they came across a bombed-out building that had been that had this inscription scrawled on the basement wall. It said, "I believe in the sun even when it's not shining. I believe in love even when it's not shown. And I believe in God even when he doesn't speak." Well, when a person is depressed, they don't think God is doing much of anything. They have no hope, they have no confidence, and God isn't easily seen by them. A person with depression needs to realize that, just like Elijah, God is working in their lives, even when they can't see him. And so God got Elijah into church. He got him to tell him what was wrong. And he corrected some of those false thinkings and beliefs. And then lastly, God gave Elijah something to do. When God had finished his counseling with Elijah, Elijah was still in the complaining mood. But God basically tells him, go back to work. I've got a job for you to do. Make yourself useful. The Lord said to him there to go back the way you came. Go to the desert of Damascus, and when you get there, anoint Hazael over Aram, and anoint Jehu king over Israel, and anoint Elisha to succeed you as prophet. Well, during his lecture on mental health, someone once asked Dr. Carl Menninger, what would you advise a person to do if that person ever felt a nervous breakdown coming on? Most people thought he would say, was go see a psychiatrist immediately. But he didn't. Much to everyone's astonishment, the doctor replied, lock up your house and go across the railroad tracks, find somebody in need, and help that person to overcome discouragement. Don't focus on yourself. Get involved in the lives of other people. Psychiatrists and psychologists and those little pills can do wonderful things for people suffering from depression. But truly, real healing is to start with God. During the first part of the 20th century, J.C. Penney was a real man who presided over a very real and powerful empire of over 1,700 stores. And at the time, he had had one of the country's largest chain of department stores, each bearing his own name. But although that enterprise made him incredibly wealthy, J.C. Penney's life was not devoid of setbacks and troubles. In fact, beginning in 1929, events took place that nearly cost him his life. When the Great Depression struck the country, it came at a time of great financial vulnerability for Penney. And through the good times before the Depression, Penney had overextended himself and had borrowed heavily to finance many of his ventures. But when the Depression finally hit banks, it began to request payment on his loans sooner than he had anticipated. Suddenly, the cash flow was tight, and Penney was finding it difficult to make those payments. Constant and unrelenting worry began to take its toll. He would say, I was so harassed with worries that I couldn't sleep. I developed an extremely painful ailment. Concerned about his deteriorating health, Penney checked himself into the Kellogg Sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan. I guess sort of like the Mayo Clinic of its era. And there, Dr. Elmer Eggleston, a staff physician, examined Penney, declaring that he was extremely ill. Penney would later recall a rigid treatment of prescribed, but nothing helped. And though he was constantly tormented by periods of hopelessness and despair, his very will to live was beginning to erode. He said, I got weaker day by day. I was broken, both nervously and physically. I was filled with despair, unable to even see a ray of hope. I had nothing to live for. I felt that I didn't have a friend left in the world, that even my family had turned against me. And then, alarmed by his rapid deterioration, Dr. Eggleston gave Penney a sedative. And that quickly wore off, and Penney awakened with the conviction that this was his last day on earth. And getting out of bed, he said that he wrote farewell letters to his wife and his son, saying that he did not expect to see the dawn. Penney did awaken the next morning, surprised to find himself alive. And making his way down the hallway of the hospital, he could hear singing coming from the little chapel where the devotional exercises were held each morning. The words of the hymn he heard being sung spoke deeply to him. Going into the chapel, he listened to the singing. He listened to the reading of the scripture, the lesson, and the prayer. And he said, suddenly something happened. I can't explain it. I can only call it a miracle. I felt as if I had been instantly lifted out of the darkness of a dungeon into a warm, brilliant sunlight. I felt as if I had been transported from hell to paradise. I felt the power of God as if I had never felt it before. For Penney, that was a life-transforming instant. Penney knew that God, with his love, was there to help him. He said, from this day, my life has been free from worry, he declared. The most dramatic and glorious 20 minutes of my life were those that I spent in that chapel. Well, the words of the hymn that were spoke so eloquently and miraculously in a way to J.C. Penney were these, and Rick is going to lead us in that invitation song. So the invitation song is the song that Penney heard, and that's what we'll use tonight. If there's anyone here that's not a Christian, we urge you to make that decision. If you are a Christian and need the prayers of this congregation, we offer this time for you to make that known as well, as together we stand